Session number 15474, reel 3.
Mr. Jones, reel 3.
Yes, we were bound, obviously, for Al-Maza, which was a suburb of Cairo, and where the Royal Artillery base depot was. And this was an education, the Al-Maza, not only because of its easy proximity to Cairo, a city which fascinated me and still does, but because there, at that time, we were talking about August 1942, everything was being prepared, if we but knew it, for the outbreak from El Alamein. But within the camp at Al-Maza were desert veterans, and their stories were we listened to their stories like you imagine, you know, the children in the picture of the boyhood of Raleigh. We absorbed desert lore, and you realize that desert people were very like seafarers. They moaned all the time while they were at sea, but as soon as they got back, they wanted to get back to the sea. And desert people were like that. And it was so true, of course, but when we got to the desert, this was the desert has this sort of fascination for you. It has also another analogy, and that is that in the desert, navigation is all important, as it is at sea. Independence, self-sufficiency, all these things is typical of life in the desert. The other thing too about these people was that they, you often ask me several times about the question of morale. These people had been knocked back perhaps even several times from Tobruk. At that particular time, the latest knockback was from the Ghazala Box, which is just south of Tobruk. And so you would think they would be demoralized, but no. No, the next time it'll be different. We'll do it next time. And when we got the right stuff, we'll have the right stuff, and we'll do it next time. And this was a great boost to morale. Also, of course, we then got the six-pounders. Everybody knew by then that the two-pounders were hopelessly inadequate. And whilst people complained about the relative conditions of the six-pounders. Indeed, the first six-pounders we had when we went to fire them didn't even have protective rubber things on the sights, so that when the machine recoiled, any one of us that was laying would get a black eye. And we had this wonderful sight of all people with black eyes going into Cairo at night, looking like bruisers. Until they arrived, it was quite hard, you know, to keep your eye on the sights and try to avoid injury. The six-pounders were there. That was the important thing. The fact that they went polished and finished and you could cut your hands on the raw welding didn't really matter. We'd got them, and we got them in proliferation. We were supplied with portees, Morris commercial portees, onto which the six-pounders were mounted by ramps. And it meant really that the gun crew of six members and a driver were a totally independent ship in the desert as you went along, quite independent, your own rations, your own water to look after. And fostered a camaraderie which is difficult to describe, really. We knew we all had to depend on each other. We were at Al-Maza for a short time. We did lots of exercises into the desert, because Al Mazar was on the fringe of the desert. We did things like recognizing German tanks, and how to get out of getting bogged down in the desert using the trails, the channels that we used for mounting the gun on the portee, on the back of the portee, which was done by a hand winch ramp, wired thing, assisted by pushing, of course. It wasn't ever considered wise to fire the gun from the truck, because it the recoil was it had nothing to dig into, whereas the trail legs of a 6-pounder, when on the ground, the first couple of shots from it would dig the trail leg into the ground, and it was stable. But with tires on the back of a truck, you can imagine it would bounce quite a bit. And we were in reserve then. We sent to the other side of Cairo, at Mina, a long established, in fact, right from the First World War. I've got a picture somewhere of my wife's uncle in exactly the same camp in the with the pyramids in the background at Mina. And we stayed there, and we were at Mina when Alamein started on October the 23rd. We'd been into Cairo, and we were quite unaware until we got into the suburbs. Use the tram to get into Mina, and in and out of Mina. And when we got away from the noise of traffic, and walked to the camp, we were aware that certain big things were happening that night, because the sky was a light with flashes and bangs, and you could feel the guns even at Mina. And we were then in 30 corps troops, and we followed up the advance on November the 4th, when the Germans really did begin to retreat. Everybody moved forward, and we were held in reserve. I'm afraid it's been the story of my life, being held in reserve, my army life. And we then progressed as a unit up the desert, Mirza Matru, Fuka, Derna, and so on. And then a peculiar thing happened to me. No one would really believe it, but we were heading westward in the desert, and the signal came through that I had to go back to base, to, believe it or not, to attend a tough tactics and physical training course. Apparently Montgomery had decided that everyone had to be equipped with someone who could... He was mad on physical fitness, Montgomery. And he said that everyone in a unit had to have its own physical training people. And so my name had been put down while we were at Mina, and for this. And I thought, that's fine. That'd be nice to come when we come back to be able to go on this course. But they sent for me while we were in full flight westward, and somebody had to take me right back to Mirza Matru, to a transit camp, for me to go down to the canal zone for this course, whilst the regiment went on. I had quite an adventurous, because transit camp life is something I became quite an authority on, but transit camps their real existence, of course, is to ensure the passage up and down of people in transit. On the other hand, people in transit camps are usually quite the staff in transit camps are usually quite happy to stay as they are, and be happy to be out of the fighting. and they have to keep their numbers up, and they tend to hold back people. Now I had a job. In fact, I had to leave that transit camp because nobody was making any attempts to get me down to the canal zone. So I left on my own. First of all, hitched on the railhead had just been extended then to Merseymuttru, and I found that was too slow. So I jumped off that hobo style. Eventually got a lift in a tank transport and going back to Alexandria, and registered myself in the transit camp in Alexandria, from where they sent me down to Moasca in Ishmaelia. There again, I was in a transit camp at Moasca, where there were only two other people in there, two Australians, and they'd been there for a long time. And no intention, they were even having mail there. And nobody queried this, because the staff at Moasca Transit Camp were justifying their existence as long as there was somebody there. When I eventually found the place that I was supposed to attend to at Moasca, to my horror, I found that the course had been cancelled about a week before I'd left the unit. So I had to start the whole process again of trying to get back to my unit. This took me until a week before, no, two weeks before Christmas in 1942, when I ended up in a transit camp at El Adam, which is just outside of Tobruk. And there I stayed, again, nobody making any great attempts to get me any further. And there I stayed until the unit came back in January, heading back for the canal zone again. Sorry, touch that. Back at Mina camp, the unit came, and they had never been in action. They had never been in action. It always struck me as the most odd situation that the very people who had been doing all the fighting went on and on to Tunis, and instead of giving them a rest and sending them back to the canal zone for leave, they were sending untried units, ostensibly, and I say ostensibly because of no reason to support the argument, that there was always a threat that Turkey would come in the war, or Germans could come through Turkey and get to the valuable oil fields of the Middle East. And so they wanted to build up a strong Ninth Army force, as they did, in Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and so on. And so in January 43, I had my first leave in Alexandria, and then we moved off to Palestine and Lebanon, just about 5 hours' drive from Beirut in the hills of Lebanon, where we trained, we did everything that could occupy anybody's mind. We were in the mountains of Lebanon, and there again it was occupy the men's minds, and that really was all we did. The mountains were a great challenge. You know, we could have exercises into the mountains. But then we moved up to right up to the Turkish border at Latakia in Syria, and a tented camp in olive groves, right by the sea. Again, apart from the heat, it was very, very hot at that time. Apart from the heat, idyllic really, because we could swim every day. Had official swimming parades, and in any leisure time we'd also be swimming. And It did feel a little bit of the East. You did get a feeling that you were in the East at Latakia. I might say that while I was at in the Lebanon, I developed a very soft spot for Beirut. I'm very fond of Beirut, and I never missed the chance to get to Beirut. It seemed to have the nice mixture of the East and the West, and it was my favourite city of the Middle East. The Beirut was. After Latakia, we moved inland to Syria to Aleppo, and it was while we were at Aleppo that the army sent around requests for applications for volunteers for airborne services behind enemy lines in the Balkans. And there was something, these things did come round from time to time, but commanding officers had a right to balk any of these things if they wanted to. If they wanted to keep anybody, they could stop anybody. This said that they wanted the right across the spectrum, and every type of person was eligible. And so this friend of mine from Leeds and I, who had been together right from the 66th Anti-Tank Regiment, we both volunteered, and he was called forward shortly before I was, and was put in the now reforming Long Range Desert Group, which was to do the parachute training at Ramat David in Palestine. And so we were separated, because I was then sent to a regiment called the Raiding Support Regiment, which also had to do its airborne training at Ramat David. The Raiding Support Regiment was formed in October 1943. It might have been into September, but I didn't. We got there in November. And we had to be trained, had to do our parachute training very, very quickly, because we were wanted as soon as possible into Yugoslavia and Greece. I completed my parachute training on December the 31st, 1943. I remember that very well, because the next day I was probably mentioned a note from the first, New Year's Day is my birthday. And so I was delighted to think that I could celebrate in style after passing. But December the 31st, 1943 was notable for one not too usual thing. People do a lot of parachute jumps, but I wonder how many people have done three in one day to get it done with. You know, and that was very unusual. Not that was intended. It was just that if the circumstances and the wind conditions were right, you had to do it, because it might, the wind may be difficult for weeks after, and unsuitable for parachute jumping. So we did one in the morning, immediately threw that parachute into a truck and were whisked off to back to the airport, and took another one straight up again and did the second jump. We still had the night jump to do, and they didn't know when that would be. But they said, hang about, you know, don't go out anywhere, because we'll see what the conditions are like. And sure enough, at dusk, they called us out again, and we went and did our night jump. So that did mark me as someone unusual, to do three jumps in one day. But it was good to have it over, nicely done. In January 44, we were the first part of the Raiding Support Regiment was formed of five batteries. If I can remember what they all were. One was a mountain gun unit. One was a field artillery unit. One was a mortar unit. One was a heavy machine gun unit, and the fifth one was an anti-aircraft unit. Batteries, they were. They're terminology. I expected to get in any of the artillery units, but for some reason I didn't. And I was put in the anti-aircraft unit, which I knew nothing at all about. But it really was a misnomer, because it was the anti-aircraft application of a 0.5 Browning heavy machine gun. And it was a very minor aspect of the gun, really, because its pedestal was an incongruous, heavy, cumbersome thing that made it almost impracticable to be of use to what was meant to be a highly mobile unit. And it was quite farcical, really. In any case, we didn't see it until, that is, the pedestal, until mid-January, and when we were called to go into Yugoslavia. We never did drop into Yugoslavia. We were then sent to Port Said, and another troop ship to Taranto, from Taranto up the Italian coast to Monopoly, and from Monopoly by landing craft in overnight in darkness to the island of Viz in Dalmatia.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the role of the raiding support regiment? Was it a commando unit?
It was meant, I think, as the name implies, that whatever a specialist unit needed any sort of backup, it would fill in that function. It so happened, of course, that the group in which it appeared would therefore always be something like a commando unit. And in our particular case, and I'm talking about E battery, the battery I was concerned in, we were always in a brigade of at least two commandos, invariably number 43 Royal Marine Commando and a 40 Royal Marine Commando. But the other units in the raiding support regiment had much more individualistic roles to play. And most of them, E battery, the gun howitzer artillery unit, was similarly engaged with us in the Dalmatians, and the half of them, the mortar battery, was similarly engaged. But the other batteries were all dropped by parachute into Greece, and in fact we never saw any of them again. Never did we ever join up again with any of those other batteries. And so their functions, whatever their function was intended to be, they were vastly different in practice. There isn't much either. I've tried to find out from the Public Records Office at Kew, the war diaries there, to find out a lot more about what happened to the other units in Greece. But it's very, very sparse. It's surprising how badly recorded our activities are. And this is why people say, well, you know, see Walter Jones, because he knows something about this. He's done some research. But I haven't. The author Mike McConville is always putting people onto me, because he says Walter Jones is the authority on the raiding support regiment, which is absurd, really. It's just that he happens to know that I've done a lot of research on it. But there's very little to find out. Our records are so poor by comparison with other units when you look at Kew, that you feel quite ashamed of it, really.
You were going to tell me about Viz.
We arrived on Viz on the very day that Churchill, February the 21st, 1944, on the very day that Churchill announced in Parliament that he is no longer going to support Mihailovic's Chetniks in Yugoslavia, and all his support was going to go to Tito. We arrived in the small hours of a jet black night to a sort of surreptitious landing on the quay side at the one of the two ports of Viz, Komitsa, and there waiting for us was one of our officers who had obviously been there the night before, some commando officers, and lots of partisans. This was our first glimpse of the partisans. Fearsome lot they looked too. It made you glad that they were on your side or you were on theirs. All seemed to be big. All seemed to be very, very keen to help. In fact, they unloaded the vessel probably in about half the time it would have taken the rest of us to do it. And the other strange phenomena was among them were female voices. And this was our sort of first experience of the integration of the sexes in the partisan setup. We were crocodiles through some winding streets to a school where we spent the night. It was interesting next morning to sort of wake up in the schoolroom and see all these Zdravo Tito, Zdravo Stalin, Zdravo Churchill, boards all over the thing, but mostly Tito and mostly Stalin. And out into the streets, I forget how our equipment must have got where we were intended to go, but I know that we marched up. The island of Viz is about, I should say, about 13 miles long and say about 6 miles wide. And we were destined to the plateau on the centre of the island, which was very rugged, very, very inhospitable, really, because we're talking about February, place to be. We marched with all the kit we could possibly carry from the port through the mountains onto the plateau onto this village which was to be our home for several months, called Podselje, where we were joined about a week later by units of the 43rd Royal Marine Commando, both billeted in the same village, where Ted Stoker was, who I mentioned earlier, incidentally. And of course, I didn't know him then. The influence of the partisans was it was a tremendous impact, really. Here were these people who were probably from all over Yugoslavia, people who had been driven out from their homes of all types, Serbs, Croats, Bosnians, all mixed.